Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, aka Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Bill Dixon. Bill Dixon is a writer living in Chicago. He's an activist with the Democratic Socialists of America, and he recently received the Project Censored Award for a story on the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Jake. Glad to be here.
Now, you and I are old friends and students at the University of Chicago. We helped take over the University of Chicago there briefly.
Uh-huh.
And you're still living there and active with the Chicago DSA?
Yep, sure am, yeah.
Do you remember the one intervention that you did when I had my first radio appearance in Chicago?
Oh, yeah, ruefully. Yeah, yeah, sure. No, that was a textbook case on how not to intervene in radio interviews, for sure. Yeah, do you want to tell the story?
Sure. Well, yeah. I was being grilled by a right-wing radio talk show host for about 2 hours, and Bill called up to be a friendly questioner, throw me a softball, and then happened to drop the acronym DSA in the course of the interview, which immediately tipped the guy off to the fact that the international communist conspiracy had injected itself.
Yeah, my denial was not very convincing, as I recall. you did better, I thought.
The topic today is the socialist future of global capitalism, and you've been writing about globalism for a good 10 years now. But I thought that if for the listeners, most of whom have not recently studied their Das Kapital or their Communist Manifesto, we would return to the classical views of Marxian socialism on international capitalism. And I would frame it that that Marx was delighted with international capitalism and with what we currently call globalism because it prepared the way for worldwide solidarity. Would you say that that's an accurate interpretation of the historical?
Yeah, I think it's sort of an interesting problem with Marx, because whereas most people tend to underestimate the influence of capitalism historically, I think Marx probably went overboard. And particularly in the Manifesto and in Das Kapital, you have a portrait of a super advanced capitalism, which is, trashed feudalism and brought heavy industry into the most backward parts of the entire planet, somewhere by the mid-19th century, right? Which is an extraordinarily optimistic view of capitalism.
Still hasn't done it today.
Right, exactly, right. Part of the blind spot of Marx is a kind of ignorance of colonialism. The imperialist interregnum of global capitalism is something that he strangely doesn't recognize as happening. The idea that capitalism could make use of colonialism as opposed to automatically surpassing it, I think, is one of the big political problems for Marx.
Now, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I've often flirted with my sympathies for the Fabians, and the Fabians being non-Marxian socialists. One of the ideas that they floated was that British imperialism dialectically would bring about world solidarity, taught everyone the same language, united the third world countries with the first world in a common market, and so forth. I mean, there is this dialectical logic to both imperialism and capitalism, and the two combined, that creates the conditions for a united world.
Yeah, I think that's true. There's certainly the positive tendency of rationalization and global integration, which capitalism accomplishes. It sets common standards for both the economy and the political system. It promotes communication in certain respects. The problem, of course, is that socialists have historically tended to kind of overestimate the progressive parts of capitalism. The Fabians in England are kind of a good example of this. I don't know who put it forward, but as the Socialist International was debating colonialism at one of its last meetings, the Fabians put forward a proposal for a socialist Commonwealth of Nations, which would be based on the former countries of the British Empire. And then what this argument was all about was a kind of Fabian answer to the demand for national independence, which they thought was unnecessary. it's just precisely because they thought that there were so many progressive features of British imperialism, so to speak, that national independence would be more trouble than it was worth. Which is one of the stranger ideas to come out of the Socialist International, but by no means the worst, I guess.
Now, when we talk about the Socialist International, Marx and Bakunin and other working trade union leftist organizers back in the mid-19th century founded the first international union of left parties. And that eventually gave birth to the Socialist International, and then in the Socialist International fell apart in World War I over support for various parties supporting World War I and gave birth to the Comintern. Now, was the Comintern an integrated economy as well as, I mean, what was the Comintern a prototypical world socialism?
Maybe for a couple of months, but certainly not for very long. The problem with the Comintern, of course, was that it was dominated by the Soviet Union. And as the Stalinism advanced in the Soviet Union and corrupted socialist politics so fatally, the Comintern naturally became a kind of an afterthought of Stalin's foreign policy. So I don't think there's really much to be said for the Comintern as an organization.
It enforced certain kinds of economic policies on its subaltern nations, like forcing Cuba to grow sugar.
Right.
Things like that. But
yeah. I mean, interestingly, the Soviet recommendations for Cuba were terribly export oriented, weren't they?
I mean, this raises one of the ironies that after independence, after the decolonialization after World War II, you had the creation of the Bretton Woods, the International Economic Order, United Nations, and so forth. And then you had these two competing third world development models, export-oriented and third world development through import substitution. Would you say that the growth of the neoliberal, of the ascendance of neoliberalism in international economics, is the repudiation, the evidence that the third world import substitution model did not work? They're basically saying, okay, we're not going to buy any computers from the United States. We're going to build our own computers here in Brazil or China or wherever. We're not going to import any manufactured goods from the industrial countries. We're going to do it all in the third world. That was a demonstrable failure.
Yeah, I mean, as well as a political defeat. The relative weight of import substitution versus export oriented economies. It was of course the classic dilemma for third world nations during the Cold War, which of course dovetailed with the hope for a third way playing off the two powers against each other, the United States and the Soviet Union.
Non-aligned movement.
The dilemma of those two things has to be sort of understood in terms of the Cold War political history. After the Cold War, that's no longer quite a dilemma, and in fact, the necessity for third world economic growth is to find some way to integrate into the market. A unilateral import substitution strategy doesn't work, but the other side of it, a pure export oriented economy, has also been recognized as both economically dangerous and politically unsustainable.
No, the free marketeers have an ideological commitment to international trade. They believe that if everyone trades with everyone else and that there's no barriers to trade, everyone will be doing exactly what they do best to maximize utility in the world. Maximum utility will be gained that way. But liberals also, liberal economists, Keynesians and so forth, have also been committed to free trade, and they draw their lesson from the Great Depression, that the Great Depression was caused by trade restrictions, or trade restrictions contributed to the Great Depression. Do you think that's a cogent view in your view?
I'm no expert on economic history, but certainly the idea that trade should be sort of arbitrarily restrictive is certainly a discredited idea, I think. But I think the neoliberal idea that trade is always a good and is always the first priority for a national economy is also on the wane as well. I think there are There are important questions about national sovereignty, about domestic government intervention, what forms of international government cooperation are necessary, and what sort of international labor and environmental accords and standards that we want to have. This, I think, is the fact that these issues have taken such a central political concern, such a central political place over the past 5 to 10 years, shows that the neoliberal consensus is breaking down.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Bill Dixon, he's a writer living in Chicago, writes on international economic issues, and is an activist with the Democratic Socialists of America. Now, the United Nations was originally proposed, was floated by a lot of liberal and humanistic and humanitarian folks around the world. They had the International Agreement on Human Rights, which is still an inspiring document as far as I'm concerned. It guarantees, for instance, allegedly the signatories have guaranteed everyone a right to a job in their countries. Not very many countries actually live up to that. But you know, was the United Nations? Do you think what happened that made the United Nations not be a vehicle for a transnational democratic response to transnational capital?
That's sort of an interesting question. How much of the sort of the failures of UN style internationalism, democratic internationalism, was sort of predetermined by the conflicts of the Cold War, and how much of it was essentially the stupidity of Western leadership. I think that Europe has always had Europe and its more sort of leftward social democratic approach to internationalism. Has always been much more positive towards the UN and much more respectful of international law, as have liberals in the United States. We do have Republicans in the United States, which around half the government at least, who want to get rid of the UN, withdraw from it, and impose unilateral U.S. leadership over everywhere they can get their hands on. I think that typically progressives tend to underestimate, I think, the role of international institutions, international democratic norms, I think that tends to be a big mistake. It's not simply a masquerade for big power rationalizations.
So, underestimating the potential democratic capabilities, you know, the Socialist International hasn't underestimated it, because we had with the Willy Brandt Commission, we had a number of different commissions that were sponsored by or associated with the Socialist International that advocated transnational solutions to these economic problems, security problems, environmental problems, or whatever. So it's been part of the social democratic vision since World War II that these institutions be a vehicle for change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think there's been a long-standing both social democratic and liberal commitment to internationalism. I think that the social democratic European approach to the third world has largely been better than the liberal approach to the third world. I think that Americans kind of underestimate the our own chauvinism and myopia about international affairs. I think that the social democratic approach, also largely in response to the national liberation movements of the 60s, has been a sort of a tremendous force for global democracy and world conscience.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Europeans are also setting an example in their own country, their own continent, of the means of bringing together countries, both economically and politically.
Yeah, I mean that's a really interesting point. The European Union is not simply an economic unit. I think Americans tend to be kind of cynical about really what the European Union historically signifies for people who live in Europe. Political union is controversial in Europe, but there's a tremendous desire to avoid world wars, to make sure that World War I and World War II don't happen again, and to sort of avoid the legacy of imperialism, and to make peace as well as good business.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been working very closely on some of the post Seattle events. Now, Seattle was a response to the World Trade Organization. Mm-hmm. You've written about that, about GATT, NAFTA, and MAI. Mm-hmm. Let's just go through these acronyms real quick. NAFTA was the
North American Free Trade Organization, passed in 1993.
And it established free trade between U.S. and Canada.
And Mexico.
Yeah. And the GATT is?
That's the global, the general agreement on tariffs and trade passed in 94.
So a multilateral treaty.
Yeah, it's the document which establishes the World Trade Organization, which is the WTO.
And the World Trade Organization is the court that adjudicates trade disputes.
That's right, according to the text of GATT.
Okay. Well, what's the MAI?
Well, that was an agreement to protect foreign investment in different countries. And it first grew out of something, another acronym called the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a long-standing kind of rich boys club of rich nations.
Mostly the European nations.
Yeah, Europe plus the United States, kind of like the economic counterpart to NATO.
Mm-hmm.
And the OECD started out this thing called the MAI as a way of protecting not trade but direct foreign investment in other countries. So if you own stock or currency or plant in another country, what this would do is guarantee legal protections for your investment.
So they couldn't be nationalized.
So they couldn't be nationalized, and so they couldn't be taxed or regulated in the wrong way, which is a tremendously advanced and sophisticated legal ambition for global capital. But unfortunately, it became very controversial very fast and went down in flames.
Now, since we're not quite as willing nowadays to send in police to countries that are recalcitrant in the international economic system, mm-hmm. countries that decide to write off their debt or whatever, the World Bank and the IMF have turned out to be the two institutions that enforce these kinds of fiscal disciplines and these trade agreements. And how does that work?
Well, the IMF is the International Monetary Fund, and its membership is a couple of dozen countries, mainly funded, of course, by Europe and the United States. It was created in the aftermath of World War II to try and sort of be the fund which rebuilds the planet after the devastation of war. And it's continued to have a kind of regulatory effect on third world countries through making conditions on loans and so on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that brings us up to the present. The current anti-globalization forces are opposed to all these institutions and their effects.
Yeah.
And you've brought up a couple different examples. One is Jubilee Justice. What's Jubilee Justice about?
Well, that's a coalition of different non-governmental organizations and religious groups which have pushed for the issue of third world debt relief. Third world debt comes largely through bad economic management and military spending by third world tyrants throughout the 60s and 70s as they tried to adjust to the turbulence in the international economy brought on by the oil shocks of the 1970s. The problem, of course, is that the more that they've paid in debt to try and compensate for bad policies, the less they have to spend on urgent needs like healthcare and education and sometimes even food.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Jubilee 2000 movement is an attempt to get that debt forgiven and to make sure that future lending is directed towards actual human priorities.
And those debts are also often incurred by non-democratic dictatorships.
Exactly, right.
Who siphoned it off into Swiss bank accounts in some cases.
Right, right. And a tremendous amount of corruption is involved, but often with the oversight and the cooperation of first world countries.
Mm-hmm. Now, another campaign has been the campaign around China, which our side just lost, the campaign to keep China's feet held to the fire and not to be granted these entrance into the economic system. What was that all about, the PTR and all that?
Well, that was preferred normal trade status for China, permanent normal trade relations with China, PNTR. And the idea was that we should open up trade with China and stop this business of overseeing their human rights, their labor record, their environmental record, and make sure that trade is no longer linked to those concerns. The idea here is not that those things don't matter, but that by promoting free markets and by promoting trade, those things will magically take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the political argument that won the day. That's what Congress eventually believed.
So that issue's over now.
Well, not quite. I mean, the trade status passed, Clinton signed the bill. But but obviously, you know, China's the emerging market to beat all emerging markets. And if the free traders are right, that free trade promotes democracy, then of course we won't have any problems. And free elections will be coming soon. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't happen, look for that issue to come up again.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also written about the steel crisis, the crisis of steel in the United States.
Yeah, that's really sort of the most fascinating underreported economic story of the past 2 years. Here we have the Asian crisis, which sunk the economies of the Pacific Rim and had the sort of the overall effect on the global economy of slowing down demand for U.S. steel. What that did, of course, was cause steel prices worldwide to drop and lay off thousands of American steelworkers and put a couple of small U.S. steel firms out of business. In order to address the crisis, what the IMF did was approve a bailout package that spurred, jump-started economic recoveries in all the affected Asian countries. And what they did was spend that money, it seems, in part on very cheap steel production, which depressed U.S. steel prices even further and protracted the crisis, not in Asia, but in the United States. When the steel workers decided to complain about this and went to Congress, Congress's ignorance of globalization issues was really quite kind of staggering. They accused the steel workers of seeking protectionism and handouts and subsidies and completely ignored the international dimensions of the crisis.
Lovely. Now, you've also written about Jesse Jackson's hoop bill. What's that about?
Well, another underreported story. Typically the free trade debate in the press gets posed between people who don't want there to be a global economy, people with their heads in their sand, and folks who don't understand economic realities, and the visionary capitalists who understand that trade benefits us all. Jesse Jackson's bill, which was an alternative to the NAFTA for Africa bill, was a wonderful exception to this. It said, sure, let's open up markets to African goods, particularly from sub-Saharan nations, but let's attach some provisions to it. Namely, let's forgive third world debt relief, let's spend some money on AIDS, the AIDS crisis in Africa, and let's increase, for the first time in over 10 years, the amount of aid that we give to sub-Saharan African nations. Sub-Saharan Africa as a continent is the only continent in the world which does not have a guaranteed level of U.S. support.
I'm speaking with Bill Dixon. He's a writer in Chicago. He won the Project Censored Award in 1998 for a story on the Multilateral Agreement on Investment and writes about international trade. So these are great examples of efforts to educate the left. There's a lot of problems on the left, though, and the trade union movement in particular, between transnationalist visions of reform and response to globalization and nationalist responses. There is actually protectionism out there.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, sort of effectively in American politics, there is no real protectionist movement out there. There's no significant part of American business actually wants it. And the parts of labor that might be tempted towards protectionism simply don't have the muscle to get it through. So when people talk about protectionism, they're talking about it in a sort of a very abstract, non-political sense. On the other hand, I think a little protectionism isn't always such a bad thing. In the United States, of course, we do have a responsibility, especially to poor countries, to open up our markets to third world imports as much as possible. That helps diminish third world poverty and keeps us from a division of labor which puts American workers ahead of other workers unfairly. On the other hand, in third world countries and especially even in first world countries, a little protectionism isn't always such a bad thing. Environmentalists point out that developing domestic agriculture, for example, is sometimes the best way to protect against famine. Countries sometimes make choices about how best to develop, whether to emphasize education or national security or high-tech industries. And those aren't things that we necessarily want the market to determine exclusively. Those are sometimes things that we want democratic sovereignty to advocate best.
So you wouldn't be on the side of the IMF exploders or blower-uppers, you'd be on the side of kind of IMF reform that respected more national sovereignty, that had a kind of global Keynesian vision as opposed to a global libertarian vision.
Exactly, and that's 10 years ago that would have been just kind of a utopian view that had no political relevance. And the IMF.
We were talking about it 10 years ago.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we were talking about it. I wish we had more of an audience then. It's not the left which is the greatest danger to an active IMF. It's actually the right, Republicans and sort of the Clinton Democrat crowd want to get rid of the IMF for all but emergency bailout purposes and let the investment function that third world nations need be taken up completely by the private sector.
Mm.
I think the left needs to think twice about whether we really want that to happen.
Right. And that the IMF might be reformable into some institution that would facilitate third world development.
Precisely, yeah. I mean, you know, the IMF is, to call the IMF model of democratic accountability is probably stretching it, but it's going to be better than GM.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, finally, what's Fast Track?
Fast Track Authority is the shot heard around the world in the anti-globalization battle. It started with Fast Track Authority is the ability of U.S. presidents to negotiate and approve trade deals unilaterally without congressional consent, and then Congress would then once the thing was negotiated have to vote up or down. Nixon enjoyed it, and it was kind of sort of quietly renewed ever since then until Clinton. In 97, he wanted his Fast Track Authority renewed, and congressional Democrats and labor particularly mobilized against both the Clinton administration and the GOP leadership to bring it down, which is a really terrific victory over both Republicans and the White House, and shows the public support is firmly on the side of fair trade and greater dialogue and transparency on these issues.
Basically, the presidents won't be able to cram complex trade agreements down Congress's
right.
throat, that there'll be an opportunity for democratic debate about them.
Exactly.
And finally, I guess since we're doing this right after the election but before the results,
right.
Are you optimistic? I mean, we're students of Michael Harrington, and Michael Harrington was always such a dialectical thinker, and no matter what happened, it was an opportunity for something else.
Right.
It was an opportunity for education, opportunity for reform of this or reform of that. I mean, I'm very optimistic about reform of the electoral system out of all this mess down there.
Mm-hmm.
How are people feeling out in Chicago?
It's funny. You know, Chicago is a place where irregular ballot counting is sort of par for the course. I watch the weekly news programs, and people tend to sort of shrug their shoulders and say, "What do you mean? You know, 100 ballots are missing, 1,000 ballots are missing. Big deal." It's an interesting problem. This stuff. I'm very much a socialist for Gore. I'm looking forward to a Gore administration. I think there's good reason to be optimistic about it. And I think that part of the Gore discourse on globalization is significantly to the left of the Clinton 92 discourse on globalization, and that reflects a well-founded fear of the labor movement.
Mm-hmm. And significantly to the left of Bush, unfortunately.
Right.
If so,
yeah.
There really was a choice in that regard. Well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Dick.
Thank you for coming on board. If people want to get a hold of Bill Dixon, you can go to the changesurfer.com website, and there are links there to Bill's writings. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Previous Change Surfer radio programs can be listened to from www.changesurfer.com and streaming MP3, thanks to the Radio for All project.